Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we have with us today, in with Bordeaux being the subject, a good friend and super knowledgeable expat who works in the Bordeaux wine trade, who is an astute taster and teacher, and a master of way too many puns that I'm going to ask him not to share with us on the radio, Jeffrey Davies. How are you, Jeffrey?
Hi, Jeffrey.
Good, Tony. Good, Cindy. Good to hear from both of you.
Oh, it's very nice to hear your voice.
Look forward to being back in Baltimore in May, I think.
Oh, good. Come visit us.
That's excellent.
That's excellent.
Great. Yeah.
Good.
So now is an exciting time. It's that time of the year where the weather is the worst and all the Bordeaux writers are showing up. The Bordeaux wine trade is changed and accelerated over the last 30, 40 years, has it not?
Yes, in the sense that at least since the early 80s, we've had pretty active what we call futures campaigns, which is why, of course, all the tasters whom you just alluded are coming in here right now to taste the wines. They're all barrel samples that they will be tasting, to evaluate them and to write about them and hopefully to encourage buyers around the world to take an interest in them and to buy them on what we call a futures basis, whereby they're going to buy the wines and pay for them probably about 15 to 18 months before they're actually delivered. And hopefully by the time they are delivered, they will have gone up in value. So those who have put their money down early will stand to make a profit.
It's an interesting thing. What the factors that take us back a more than a minute to when you first arrived over there. What was the first wine that you tasted in Bordeaux that was something that changed your thought process about what your perception was of Bordeaux?
A couple things happened the first year I was here in Bordeaux as a student, which was in the school year that spread from 72 to 73. 72, as you'll recall, was a pretty dismal vintage, and I arrived just after... No, I arrived and did the harvest in 72. It was cold, and it was rainy, and it was miserable. And I said, why would anybody in his right mind want to do this? Especially a California boy just showing up from Santa Barbara where the weather was beautiful.
Perfect, right.
One of the first wines that sort of marked me, if you will, were 62 Gruau de la Rose from Saint-Julien and its stable mate of the time, 64 Talbot. And then a little bit later, in April of 73, I was invited to participate in the first futures campaign that I'd ever seen, which was the 72 campaign. Now, here's a horrible, rainy, cold vintage, and yet the wines are being bid up to prices way beyond the 70s and 71s, both of which were better than 72, without a doubt.
Yeah, I think of 71 as being a great sleeper.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So I'm thinking, this is really crazy, and it didn't seem like the prices could go high enough. And then, of course, that led us to the crash that ensued the following year with the 73 futures campaign and the so-called Bordeaux wine scandal. But that kind of shut down the whole futures thing probably for almost a decade until somebody you guys both well know, namely Robert Parker, came over here and raved about the 1982 vintage. And of all the critics prominent at that time, he was the only American and only one of two critics, the other being the French guy, Michel Betain, to extol the virtues of that vintage. All the others, mostly English at that time, were saying, oh, it's too good too soon, it's not going anywhere, forget about it. You're better off with 1981.
Oh, yeah. I remember Terry Robards writing about the 81 and just excoriating the 82s for being flaccid.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah. I say that very happily, drinking 82s from the cellar right now.
Yeah.
And I think exactly. The only 81 I could still stomach would be the Lemission.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And of course, that's interesting you mentioned 81 Lemission, because that is the very year in which the Voltner family sold Lemission and fled to California because Mitterrand had just been elected president. Just a little political side, no pun intended.
So many stories.
France always has a political side note.
It does. It does. But since 82, the futures campaigns have gone on pretty steadily ever since. I do think, and it's not a secret, that the last two or three campaigns have really tested the system, because there has not necessarily been any profit to be made by everyone in the distribution chain and, of course, the consumer. And I think for that reason, that unless the prices are perceived to be very reasonable this year, where the quality is undoubtedly the best we've had in Bordeaux since the pair 2009 and 10, it could be the end of the goose laying its golden egg. I mean, people are just going to walk.
That's been said a few times though, over the years. You know, by the time you get to, you know, the 80s are a pretty solid decade of vintages and improvement. Mm-hmm. And the 90s, a lot more uneven vintages, but they had momentum coming out of the 80s. And by the time you get to the end of the 90s, you're seeing things flatten out for a couple of years, and the euro was kind of weak, and then all of a sudden 2000 hits. In retrospect now, 2000 looks like an unbelievable bargain.
Yeah. I think there's two things that go with that. You're absolutely right that the decade of the 90s did not give us a lot of back-to-back great vintages, but there was the pressure that if you wanted the 2000s, which were coming in a year or in 2 years, you better get on board for the 97s, the 99s, whether or not you thought they were up to snuff, because otherwise you might get snuffed when it came to getting an allocation of the 2000s. The second thing is, as you point out, I think didn't the euro go into effect in 2001, then when the 2000 futures campaign was taking place? And I believe at that time, 85 cents U.S. Buy you 1 euro. So it did make them, you're right, very attractive.
I recall buying a bunch of 98, 99, and 2000 Chateau Lafite Rothschild at super ludicrous prices. I mean, fifth growth prices right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, the system could work again if the Chateau are reasonable. And I'm already hearing that, you know, since the dollar is way back up against the euro, that certainly the market ought to accept a 10, 20% increase in the prices here. And I, like many others, are telling the Chateau owners that's not true. It's not going to work that way, because when the euro goes up against the dollar, you guys don't lower your prices. And additionally, there's a lot of wine out there from 10, 11, and 12 that people can buy today with a much stronger dollar than they did if they bought it on futures 2 and 3 years ago and paid for it. So you better be very careful how you wield that argument.
Let's talk for a minute about how wine has changed over the years in Bordeaux since you've been there.
Unlike many of the English, I think wine in Bordeaux has only gotten better. And I think that if you look at the decade, you talked about the decades of the 80s and 90s, but if you look at the decade that begins with 2000, and you go back and taste a lot of the wines, even from vintages that we didn't have much hope for, like 2002, 2007, and so forth, we never would have made the quality of wines in those difficult vintages that we did had we moved back 20 or 30 years. I think that, as a whole, the decade beginning in 2000 produced more great vintages than any decade, probably since the second half of the 40s. And I think that our mastery of vineyard techniques, viticultural techniques, handling of the fruit, sorting of the fruit, cellar hygiene, working more with gravity, working more with new and cleaner oak, being much more selective, having second or even third wine, so that really only the very, very best goes into the so-called grand vin, means that most of the wines in Bordeaux are considerably better than they have been at any time in the past. Now, this, I know, always offends the English, because they hark back to some period, I don't know when it was, that Bordeaux was supposedly much better than it is today.
They hark back to the period when they felt like they could control the entire market, and they were the only arbiters of quality in Bordeaux.
Yeah.
And Bordeaux is a global wine now, for sure, for at least the last decade.
Yeah. Although I think this year, more than any year in the recent past, I think the United States will be the market that either makes or breaks the futures campaign. I think the Chinese, with the anti-corruption programs that are in place, will largely sit it out. And with the Chinese largely absent, the English will be less active than normally because, of course, they resell so much of the wine that they buy to Hong Kong and China. Japan is still in the throes of economic doldrums, so I don't think they're going to be very active. France, well, I think we already addressed that a little bit earlier, is not going to be a major player because there's just not the disposable income. However, in the United States, as you well know, the economy seems to be perking up. The dollar has certainly perked up by some 25% just in the last 6-7 months. So if there's a market that could make or break this campaign, I do think it will be the U.S. My confrères négociants believe the same thing because they've all been crisscrossing the United States for the past few months, like in a crazy fury.
So maybe maybe give a couple of tips of where you think great value is in Bordeaux right now for a current consumer, and a couple of wines that are close to your heart right now that you're pulling from your cellar. Two very different questions.
Yeah. Since we both know him well, I'm tempted to say that Bob Parker is the only one that has really spent as much time as any wine writer trying to ferret out and taste the great value wines of Bordeaux. So many writers who come here just want to be received in the Grand Cru Classé of the Médoc, be wined and dined, and write a few glowing remarks about their wines and go home. I don't think that serves the consumer necessarily. And Bob has spent so much time writing about the great value wines. They may be from the simple Bordeaux Supérieur appellation. Beyond that, they would probably be from Castillon, from Fronsac, from Graves, as opposed to Pessac-Léognan. There's a whole bevy of great value wines to be found in those appellations, I believe. And I think with the...
I think the bottles of wine from Bordeaux that hit retail shelves at $19.99 and at $24.99, at $29.99, those are the bottles that make or break the reputation of... Like, I'm actually spending a bit of real money... The wine is good, or the wine is
right.
Not good. You know, I think that, and that's where you're talking about the Grave or the Côte de Castillon. If you can find a 10 that's out there or a 9 that's out there from those appellations and a good grower, you may very well find those prices and you may find something that's terrific.
I agree, and I think that what has surprised me and many of the people here in the trade is how the 2012 vintage has evolved since it was bottled, in most cases, 6 to 7 months ago. And in addition, their prices, if you're paying for them in dollars today, makes them very attractive. But the wines really plumped up, fleshed out, and developed some wonderful fruit quality that many of us did not see early on when they were first shown en primeur. And I'm very anxious to see if Bob doesn't upgrade many of his initial assessments as he tastes them in the next couple of weeks.
Well, let me push you to go ahead and wrap the segment with two wines you're pulling from your cellar right now that you think are just that you have deep romantic feelings about, Jeffrey.
I can't wait to hear
the
answer to that.
I know how you get.
One that really has delighted me, because now we're at that 10-year mark, I wanted to go back and taste some 2005s. And one that really surprised me in a very positive way is a Grand Cru Classé from Saint-Emilion called Clos des Jacobins, which belongs to the de Coster family and is up on the upper plateau of Saint-Emilion in sandy, gravelly, some limestone soil. And it's just seamless and fruity and with good length. It's maybe not the most profound Saint-Emilion I've ever tasted, but it's just absolutely delicious. And
it's
also be from Saint-Emilion, the 98 Montbousquet, which, as you know, in the 2006 and 12 classifications became a Grand Cru Classé. It's just showing beautifully now, and it's going on, 16 years?
That 98 was always a big punch in the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
That was a statement wine to me.
Could be more romantic than a punch in the mouth?
Oh, gee.
Well, everyone has different feelings about has different feelings about how they celebrate those feelings, Jeffrey.
But the other thing I would say too, if I may, is what amazes me is how many properties today, particularly in Saint-Emilion, have received a lot of new capital influx, investment, management change, improvement. And so if I could just cite maybe not quite a half dozen ones that I think are really worth following, I would say La Dominique, Bellefonds-Belsier, Sansonnet, and at a slightly lower price point, Tours Saint-Christophe, right across the Vale from Bar de Haut. Those are four that quickly pop into my mind that I think are really going to be worth looking for consumers. In recent vintages, 2012, even their 13s are not so bad, and then definitely in 14.
Well, thank you very much for the intel, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Nice to talk with you.
Nice to speak with you.
Good to see you and talk to you, rather, more than see. I do look forward to seeing you come May when I'll be over there with a chateau owner from Saint-Emilion, and we'll be doing a tasting with our friend out in Moncton and hopefully coming back into to Baltimore and to the Charleston.
Very good.
Terrific. Let's organize something.
Yes.
Thanks, wonderful.
Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Have a good day.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
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 When we come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine, we're going to wrap up with a segment about some of the traditional dishes, some recipes that Cindy was inspired by, and I think she's going to quiz me to give you a little bit of wine 101 on grapes and terroirs and all the silly names of things that you're going to be forced to know on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine on WYPR.